Welcome to Akhotra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling a truly massive work, maybe the masterpiece from John Steinbeck, the 1952 novel East of Eden. Steinbeck, you know, Nobel winner, famous for capturing that American spirit. And he sets this incredibly ambitious story right in his own territory, the Salinas Valley in California. Big canvas.
Huge. And it feels almost biblical in scope, which, well, it fits perfectly, right? Because
sure.
This book really goes way beyond the social commentary people knew him for.
Yeah, it's different from Grapes of Wrath or Of Mice and Men.
Exactly. He actually wrote this as a kind of personal message for his own sons, trying to lay out some kind of moral map for them. It wasn't about like external poverty this time. It was all about the internal stuff, the human heart.
And that internal landscape, as you say, it's completely framed by the Cain and Abel story from Genesis. So our goal today really is to unpack this huge, sprawling family, story two families, the Trasks and the Hamiltons, and trace Steinbeck's big idea that this constant battle between good and evil, fate and choice, well, it all comes down to one single powerful word.
That's it, absolutely. So to get started, you kind of need the backdrop, the moral landscape, if you will.
Yeah.
We begin late 19th century. And we meet the Hamiltons first.
Right, the good guys almost.
Yeah, led by Samuel Hamilton. He's this wise, warm Irish immigrant. They're decent, hardworking people, kind of the story's moral center, you know, the everyday goodness in the valley.
And they really serve as a contrast, don't they, to the sheer drama and darkness of the Trask family.
Definitely.
Because that cycle of tragedy kicks off with the patriarch, Cyrus Trask. He really sets the stage for all the dysfunction that follows. He's fundamentally dishonest, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
He builds this whole military hero reputation basically on... well, on lies.
Total fabrication. And that rotten foundation, that falsehood, it just poisons everything for his kids.
Mm-hmm.
And right away, in his two sons, Adam and Charles, you see that first clear Cain and Abel dynamic play out. Adam's the gentle one, maybe a bit passive. He's the Abel.
And Charles?
Charles is the volatile one. Physical, angry, jealous. He's Cain through and through.
But it's not just them, is it? It's Cyrus himself, the father, who fuels it.
Yeah.
His favoritism towards Adam is just overwhelming, and he absolutely crushes Charles with rejection.
Yeah, that rejection gets solidified in this one absolutely pivotal scene. Really defines the whole Trask path. It's Cyrus's birthday.
Okay.
Charles has worked like crazy, saved up, and he buys his dad this really expensive, beautifully made German knife, a serious gift.
Right. Thoughtful, earned.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Adam, the favorite, he just finds a stray puppy wandering around and gives that to his dad. Simple, no effort really.
And Cyrus's reaction tells you everything you need to know.
Oh, absolutely. He basically dismisses Charles's knife, says, you know, you earned this, I expected it, there's no heart in it. But the puppy, he goes completely over the top, praising Adam, saying it's a true gift, full of love.
It's just brutal. Steinbeck shows you the injustice right there. Charles's hard work, rejected. Adam's casual, fouled gift. Glorified.
And that unfairness, that arbitrary rejection, it's the poison, like you said. Charles, just eaten up with jealousy and feeling wronged, later attacks Adam and beats him almost to death.
Wow.
So the pattern is locked in right there. The father's rejection leads straight to the brother's violence, and the Trasks are stuck in this cycle of sin.
It's a devastating start.
Mm-hmm.
And if Charles represents that first tragedy, the one born from rejection, then the second one? Well, walks in on two legs and destroys any chance Adam had for a peaceful life. Kathy Ames.
Kathy. Steinbeck uses her in this very specific, almost chilling way. He basically tells us she's a monster, born without a conscience, without the capacity for good. It's like a clinical study of sociopathy.
She's pure calculation, malice, just driven by self-interest and this need to cause pain.
Utterly terrifying. But it does make you wonder, right, if the whole point of the book is Tim Schell, free will. Why create a character who seems completely predetermined? Like, she has no choice but to be evil.
That's a great question. Maybe she's the ultimate test.
I think that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
She tests the whole idea of Eden, the possibility of goodness. She operates outside normal human rules. And Adam. Well, Adam makes himself the perfect target for her.
How so?
He finds her after she's been badly beaten, and his own, like, desperate idealism kicks in. He sees her not as she is, but as this pure, victimized angel he needs her to be. He completely ignores the warnings Charles gave him about her darkness.
He thinks he can save her, build his perfect Eden in California with her.
Exactly. But that dream just gets obliterated. After she gives birth to their twin boys, Cal and Aaron, she shoots Adam.
Shoots him.
Shoots him, yeah. and just abandons him and the babies. And she doesn't just vanish. She reinvents herself as Kate, this cold, incredibly successful, ruthless madam running a high-class brothel in Salinas. Talk about corrupting the promised land.
Wow. And the impact on Adam.
It breaks him. His whole ideal world is just shattered. He falls into this deep, years-long emotional paralysis, Steinbeck calls it. He basically checks out as a father.
So he becomes neglectful. Just like his own father was to Charles, in a way.
Precisely. Psychologically absent. And that neglect, of course, just sets up the whole tragic cycle to repeat with the next generation.
Okay, so now we meet the twins. Aaron, the fair-haired, seemingly pure one. Naturally, the distant Adam favors him. He's the new Abel. And then there's Cal. Dark, intense, constantly grappling with this terrible fear that he's inherited his mother's evil. He's the new Cain.
Yeah, Cal's whole life is defined by that fear. Is he doomed by his blood? Is he inherently bad? Every single thing he does is shadowed by that anxiety, that struggle against his perceived nature.
He's desperate to prove he's not his mother. Desperate for the love Aaron seems to get so easily.
Absolutely. But if the Trask family itself is kind of stuck in this silent, repeating trauma, the insight, the key to maybe breaking the cycle, actually comes from someone outside the family drama, Lee.
Ah, Lee.
Yeah.
The family's Chinese servant. He is, you could argue, the absolute moral core of the book.
He really is. He plays this role, you know, speaks in this sort of broken pigeon English publicly because that's what people expect.
Right.
But in private, with Adam, with Samuel Hamilton, you find out he's incredibly well-educated, deeply philosophical. He becomes the real parent figure for those boys.
The one they desperately need.
And Lee's the one who does the deep dive, the real research. He sees this repeating Cain pattern generation after generation and thinks we have to go back to the source, back to the original story in Genesis.
Oh, he gets together with some Chinese scholars.
Exactly. To look at the original Hebrew text, specifically the part where God speaks to Cain after his offering is rejected, talking about mastering sin.
And this is where we get the absolute heart of the novel's philosophy, the word Timshel.
Yes. Lee explains their findings. There were basically three ways that Hebrew phrase could be translated into English. One was, thou shalt rule over sin, like a command, an order.
Okay. Destiny.
Sort of, yeah. Or maybe just a promise of success. Another translation was, do thou rule over sin, a direct instruction.
Right. An imperative.
But the third possibility, the one the scholars felt was the most accurate translation of the original Hebrew, was thou mayest.
Thou mayest.
Thou mayest rule over sin. And Lee realizes this is everything. This one word changes the whole game. It's not a command, not a prediction of failure. It's choice.
It grants agency.
Precisely. It means humans aren't doomed by sin, nor are they guaranteed to overcome it. They have the choice, the power to decide their own moral path, no matter their background, their parents, their genes. It rests with them. Thou mayest. You can choose.
Wow. That's profound. And that idea, that power of choice, it gets tested almost immediately, doesn't it? When Adam loses all the family money.
Yeah, Adam sinks the rest of the fortune into this this harebrained scheme to ship refrigerated lettuce east. Total disaster. Wipes them out financially.
And Cal sees this as his moment.
His big chance. He cooks up this plan. It's smart, but definitely morally murky to make a fortune profiteering on beans during wartime. And he succeeds. He makes $15,000.
A huge sum back then.
Massive. And he plans to give it all to Adam to replace the lost money and finally buy that love and approval he craves.
Which leads us to maybe the most painful scene in the whole book, the climax.
Oh, it's agonizing. Cal, just brimming with hope, presents this pile of cash to Adam. And Adam, he just can't accept it.
Why not?
Because in his rigid, idealistic mind, it's dirty money, war profiteering, tainted. He rejects it completely, coldly. And worse, he compares it negatively to Aaron's simple good conduct medal from school.
Oh, no. He does the exact same thing his own father did to Charles.
Exactly. The devastating rejection, the dismissal of earned effort in favor of something simple from the favored son. Adam, who was the victim of that same dynamic, now perpetuates it onto Cal. The cycle snaps right back.
And Cal's reaction?
It's pure rage and pain. He doesn't hit Adam, but he lashes out in the cruelest way possible. He decides to destroy Aaron's idealism because he knows that's what Aaron treasures most and what Adam values in Aaron.
So he takes Aaron.
He maliciously takes Aaron to Kate's brothel and forces him to see the truth about their mother, who she really is.
Oh, that's just devastating. Aaron couldn't handle that, could he?
Not at all. His whole pure idealistic worldview just shatters. He can't reconcile the goodness he believed in with this this absolute evil, being his own mother, he enlists in the army that same day, runs away to World War I.
Seeking escape, maybe?
Yeah.
Or punishment?
Maybe both. And very soon after, he's killed in action.
Leaving Cal utterly consumed with guilt. He feels like he really is Cain now. He killed his brother.
Yeah, it confirms all his worst fears about himself. He believes he's fulfilled the curse.
So how does it resolve? Is there any redemption possible after that?
Well, the news of Aaron's death causes Adam to have a massive stroke. He's paralyzed, can't speak. It looks like he's going to die having failed Cal one last time, trapped in that cycle of rejection.
But Lee steps in again.
Lee refuses to let it end that way. He goes to Adam's bedside, pleads with the dying man, essentially urging him somehow to release Cal from this crushing weight of inherited sin, to give him the blessing of Timshel, to affirm his freedom to choose.
And does Adam respond?
In his very last moments, barely conscious, Adam looks at Cal, his surviving, tormented son, and he manages to whisper one single word.
Let me guess.
Timshel.
Wow.
It's the ultimate act of forgiveness. It's Adam finally understanding and offering that gift of choice, breaking that generations-long chain of predetermined fate that haunted the Trasks.
So the novel suggests the real monster, in a way, wasn't Kathy Ames with her inherent evil.
No, maybe the real monster was the belief in monstrousness being inescapable. The belief that we're just puppets of our parents' mistakes or our own worst impulses. Mm. Determinism itself.
So if we pull back and look at the big themes, East of Eden seems to argue that so much human suffering stems from that paternal rejection, right? That failure to give love freely.
Absolutely. That's the catalyst.
And then the failure, perhaps because of that rejection, to grab hold of your own free will, to believe in Temshel.
Exactly. But the final message isn't bleak at all, is it? It's actually incredibly hopeful.
Yeah, it feels really empowering by the end. Steinbeck seems to be telling us that the real fight, the real East of Eden, isn't a place. It's inside us.
Mm-hmm. It's that constant daily negotiation between our darkness and our light. Our choices aren't always these huge dramatic things. It's about how we choose to be day by day, despite everything. Our history, our fears, our genes.
It's a masterpiece, really. And it leaves you feeling, well, energized. Knowing that no matter what darkness might be in your past, or even in your nature, the power to shape your own moral self, that rests entirely with you. That's the profound beauty of Thou Mayest.
Well said. The struggle is universal, but so is the possibility of choosing a better path.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.